Roger Moore is James Bond 007 in Ian Fleming's Moonraker. And Jaws is back to put the bite on Bond. James Bond and Jaws are face to face in outer space in Moonraker.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the James Bond Complex. My name is Edgar.
My name's Matt.
Welcome back, everybody. This time, episode 8, I believe, we are going to discuss a true piece of cinematic art. Moonraker.
A masterpiece.
A masterpiece, if you will, from the inimitable... what's this director's name?
Lois Gilbert. A mirthful masterpiece.
And it's called Moonraker, 1979, on the heels of a little-known, at the time, independent film.
And then, at the time, an independent film.
Called Star Wars.
Yes.
Big influence.
Barely noticeable.
Am I misremembering, or at the end of The Spy Who Loved Me, it says James Bond will return in For Your Eyes Only? Does it not say that?
It does.
It says that, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Then Star Wars comes out. Actually, same summer, I think. Same summer.
Actually, a few months. I think Star Wars came out in May. And if I remember the marketing for The Spy Who Loved Me, it came out 7th of July, 1977.
Yeah, they get as many sevens in there as possible. And good old Cubby sees Star Wars and goes like, holy smokes.
Oh, my God. I know what we were doing next. We're going to Moonraker.
And we're going to use science fact.
Science fact.
He says this
here,
in the DVD.
At Moonraker, we're doing science fact, not science fiction.
I love my interpretation.
It's a solid interpretation. I will give you that. And that is a great quote. I have seen that quote before. I've watched that quote before. I love it. We're doing science fact.
He's wrong and he's right at the same time. That's the beauty of it. Because at this time, nobody has seen the space shuttle.
And is that your argument for he's getting it right?
There's some thought to some of the ideas, like the artificial gravity, the way it's spinning. It's more or less what I think they explain how it would actually work in space. There's some reflection,
I guess so,
on the technology and the production design, the way the shuttles look, everything. Yeah, it's pretty much accurate for 1979. If I had never seen the space shuttle, it would work for me. But that's a minor part of the movie. Like, the space thing is maybe the last 15 minutes.
Yeah, and a lot happens before the space thing.
Yeah.
Speaking of plot.
Oh, do you want to give me the plot? So what happened? Tell me, Edgar.
You want to know? You got 20 minutes? So after the delightful gun barrel sequence, we witness a hijacking. The Moonraker shuttle, so like in the book, it's an actual shuttle, although there are multiple Moonrakers. It is riding on the back of a particular plane. It is on loan from NASA to the British. And these two clandestine passengers hijack the Moonraker and, quote, steal it. In comes James Bond, because it is, in some particular fashion, England's responsibility because NASA was loaning it. James Bond is sent to California, where Drax Industries is located. So we have Hugo Drax. Is he a sir in the film?
No, he's not.
He's not a sir in the film. So we have Hugo Drax, played by Michael Lonsdale, in California. And there is one of his leading astronauts, Miss Holly Goodhead, played by the... I love Lois Childs. I absolutely love Lois Childs. She is an astronaut, fully trained, which to a degree impresses Bond. I don't think Bond sees that coming. Of course, we got good old Roger. Bond investigates Drax Corporation from California to Venice, from Venice to Brazil in Rio de Janeiro, from Rio to the Amazon, essentially, and from the Amazon to space. Lots of trials and tribulations. There's a glass factory. There is a particular plant which has a poison attached to it. What's going on? Drax, he gets annoyed. He gets for I can you're doing you give me some hand gestures. I'm getting to it, Matthew. Drax is annoyed. Bond keeps showing up with the tediousness of an unloved season. So Drax is on the phone. I want to know who Drax is talking to. I want to know who he's talking to.
A spinoff idea.
I guess so. And, you know, Bond's really pissed him off at this point, so he needs to get rid of Bond once and for all. And just, oh, well, if you can get him, of course. In comes Jaws. Everybody's in this movie. So we go off into space, and essentially, Hugo Drax, industrialist, in this film, is essentially planning. He is the interspatial version of Carl Stromberg. Basically, yeah. Where Stromberg wanted to take civilization underwater, Hugo Drax wants to take human civilization into space, although only temporarily. He hires a bunch of models from a bunch of different countries, asks them to fornicate so they can repopulate planet Earth after our planet has been infected with this poison, which comes from the plants, the poison which was transported in the glass, hence the glass factory. So it sort of all comes together. It's a little far-fetched, and we get space battle at the end. NASA has a space marine platoon, and there are lasers, and it's great. I love it when the astronauts are, like, spinning out of control. Big space battle, Moonraker station, which was hidden from everybody's view because of radar jamming system. And it blows up. They get rid of the poison. Jaws becomes a goodie. He was a baddie. Now he's a goodie because Bond makes him realize that Drax's vision of perfection, these models, does not apply to Drax, and or does not apply to Jaws, and Jaws is a delightful little girlfriend. So he becomes a goodie. Everybody saves the day, including Jaws. And as live video footage, which is being fed to the White House and Buckingham Palace of the, I believe, the only remaining Moonraker shuttle, which, not a Moonraker shuttle, a pod, which Bond and Holly Goodhead are in. They are making love to the shock and dismay of the Ministry of Defense, who demands, what's Bond doing? And Q, not looking at Bond and Holly Goodhead, but some sort of a radar system, says, I believe he's attempting re-entry, sir. And Holly Goodhead asks, take me around one more time, James. Cue the disco theme of Moonraker. So that's Moonraker for you in a nutshell. It took me about 3-4 minutes, but we got through it.
Yeah, that's shorter than...
Shorter than your version of the book. I think we have a lot to talk about, and only so much time to talk about those things. Where do you even begin? Moonraker.
I'm going to start with the beginning, as I tend to do with these things.
I guess that makes sense, start at the beginning.
I love, for some reason, even as a child, I loved the shuttle thieves. Those two guys that steal the shuttles.
Wearing leather jackets?
Yeah, I don't know.
Is that space attire? Is that proper space attire?
It's not, but those guys, they look and they feel like they should be like hench people.
They look awesome.
Yeah, but they do. Technically, you think they commit like murder. They kill a bunch of pilots, and it's really I don't know. It's really violent and grotesque the way they die, and they just look kind of cool.
You could, you know what? I could envision these two guys. We have a picture, which you can, I'm sure, easily find on the Google,
or just watch a movie.
Watch the movie. These two guys, I can see them not as hijackers in a Bond film, but as like top of the line thugs in like a 70s cop show or something like that. You know, but smart. Like they're not
like Joel Teeth.
They're thuggish, but with a dash of peppered with a bit of class about them, but they're still thugs at the end of the day.
Yeah.
I can see those guys being that. They're awesome. I like them.
And you see them for 1 second, they don't come back in the movie. I was kind of shocked by that. This movie has many, 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 many...
Stupid things,
flaws, distraction. It's sluggish at times, but it has like one, if not the best, opening sequence in any Bond movie.
It is unbelievable. And I think because Moonraker and Spy are so similar plot-wise, and most people agree that Spy is the superior film, this pre-title sequence tends to get forgotten. guys, it is mind-blowing.
It's the reason to watch a movie.
You, if you so choose, you could shut this off when the song starts. It is an amazing opening sequence. It's insane.
They did 80 what jumps. What the hell? 80 jumps.
In California, I think they did that over California, yes, as I did. Was reading. And just to have that much film footage as they're dropping out of the sky, 80 sounds like that's almost not enough. That's like, I felt like they could have done 80 more. They have so much footage. They can't be filming for 5 minutes at a time. They're filming for 30 seconds, 20 seconds.
Just about. And what's funny about it, because obviously most people don't, probably even to this, they know proper attire and stuff about parachuting. And my cousin actually has his licenses. I don't know which degree he has. He's done many.
Is that the same one that can make a golden gun?
Actually, it is.
Your cousin's pretty cool.
Yeah, my cousin's awesome. When he was discussing parachuting with me, he explained to me that you need to be tied so tight in your ties, like the parachute can't move. And it's funny in that movie because Bond is thrown off the plane without a parachute, attacks the guy, manages to steal his parachute.
Pretty easy, actually.
And, yeah, and puts it on, and it's just one clip. And usually, like, the F's chops. It's like a backpack. It's not realistic.
The Boy Scouts here.
But it's such a great sequence. And John Barry is back. Because if you're going chronologically, he missed The Spy Who Loved Me. He's in top form. And he does something that he doesn't do often. He uses the James Bond theme as in an action sequence. Mm. He tends not to do that, but it's great.
And it's got a bit of a beat. Like, there's a bit of... I'm making it sound like a disco, but there's a drum going on, yeah, in the back there.
And it's great. I mean, when Jaws comes flying, he looks like a bird of prey.
Like a hawk.
Yeah, the way he holds his arms, it's just great.
It's great imagery.
Yeah.
It's very iconic. It's, you know, very memorable.
You know, it's not really Roger Moore, it's not Richard Keogh, but it's still an amazing sequence.
I'm wondering if that's one of the first films, what's his face, they hired him for so many movies after that, B.J. Worth?
Yeah, he doubles for the guy that Bond steals his parachute from. Or I don't know. He plays one of the guys. I don't know who plays Jaws, but one of them is B.J. Worth, but I don't remember which one. But the parachute sequence is the best. And it's...
You know what I liken it to? I always, you know, in 2018, you know, who cares about underwater sequences? But back in 1965, Thunderball was freaking amazing with it.
Yeah.
This is kind of like that. Like, oh my God, they are filming while everybody's falling to the ground from a plane. It feels like that kind of spectacular, visceral, something new, something fresh, something dangerous. I love it. I absolutely... I will say this. It's kind of dumb when Jaws tries to pull his parachute. Okay, he's so strong that he broke the cord. But then he starts flapping his arms like, yeah, a bird. That's kind of stupid.
And they have two parachutes in a pack. You have a safety parachute.
And what does he fall into? A circus, you know. And you know.
It signals the tone of the film. But I feel it's saved by... It's not the best, but it feels... And it should be taken almost this way. Like the song and the visual, it feels like a dream. It's very like...
It's very soft.
It's something I... Like if I had a child, I would play that as I put them to sleep.
I suppose. So it's certainly... Of the three Shirley Bassey songs, it's certainly the soft. It is the one that has the lightest touch to it. Goldfinger is very powerful. Diamonds Are Forever is incredibly sexy. This one feels like a soft peck on the cheek.
Yeah, but it's dreamlike. It's just, oh, I just want to go to bed.
Mm. I also feel that, you know, Morris Binder, bless his heart, is often those that elect to criticize him to a degree often say, well, his imagery is often alike, and I can maybe kind of see that. I actually find he's sort of in top form in this pre-title sequence.
And it's the first time we actually see James Bond in the credits.
Is this the first time?
This is the first time. Pretty sure.
We do not see him in...
Does Spy Love Me? I don't think so. You don't see him in any other one. Maybe in The Spy Who Loved Me. Now you make me doubt myself. It's mostly like people jumping around and being nude.
Yeah, but we just saw people like jumping out of a plane. Yeah. So it kind of makes sense. And they're jumping very slowly, and we have the zero-G gravity later in the movie. Like, it kind of makes sense. The
thing is that Morris Bender was limited but with the technology of his time. I'm pretty sure if he, like, some of the visuals, like, you have to think, he's using, like, giant machines, like splicers and technology that...
there's a lot of optical effects in these pre-titles, in the title sequences themselves. They're basically the 60s and 70s versions of music videos, for all intents and purposes, before that was really a thing, which it's not really anymore at this point.
Oddly enough. The thing is, if he had a computer in the 60s, he would have done probably what Daniel Kleinman has been doing probably since Casino Royale. And
GoldenEye, no? What Daniel Kleinman was in the 90s.
Yes, he was. But I think in the last, especially the last two, it's not just visuals as he was doing. For GoldenEye, it's visuals. There's a theme, but there's... He's telling a story. Morris Binder, if he had a computer in the 60s to 70s, he would have done something like that, but he was limited with technology that was available to him in the time that he had to do. But he still influenced... Well, he influenced Kleinman, because Kleinman is, especially for GoldenEye, is quite literally copying the visuals that Binder was doing, but in a 20th century version at the time.
No, absolutely. In the previous episode, we waxed poetic a lot about dear Hugo Drax, our favorite villain to date in the books. What do you think of Hugo Drax in Moonraker, the film?
You appear with the tedious inevitability of an unloved season.
I didn't think there were any seasons in space.
As far as you're concerned, only winter and the treacherous Dr. Goodhead. Despite your efforts, my finely wrought dream approaches its fulfillment.
Your dream, whatever sort of nightmare it is, has no chance, Drax.
You think not? We shall see.
We're coming up to second launch position.
Launch globe number two. No doubt you have realized the splendor of my conception. First, a necklace of death about the Earth. 50 globes, each releasing its nerve gas over a designated area, each capable of killing 100 million people. The human race, as you know it, will cease to exist.
I love him.
Yeah. He's fun.
He's fun. He has such a great delivery. And he's French. I don't think I would have known if I didn't read that.
You know, I knew Michael Lonsdale. It's not a very French name, but I knew he was French. I've actually seen him in a couple French films before, both at around that time and several years afterwards when he was a much older man. But maybe he doesn't sound like true English, like, it's really close though. Like, his English is very English.
Funny thing, he was in a movie with another James Bond actor. He was in Munich. He plays
Daniel Craig.
It popped in my mind because I'm like, I've seen him in a more recent movie. Oh yeah, it's true. It's Munich.
Yeah,
Munich.
The sequel to Moonraker.
I'm keeping the joke.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of Hugo Drax in this film as well. He's not as prominent in the film as he is in the book. He's such an integral part of the book. He's less so in the film. There are large stretches of
the
running time.
Very different also. His origins are
completely... He's not English. He's not a Nazi. He's as crazy as a Nazi, but he's not a Nazi.
He has a similar plot to the Nazi. I think, like I was discussing with you, I think they initially planned to make him a Nazi because I've seen some... make behind the scenes stuff, and they had makeup tests where they aged Michael Lonsdale.
I'd like to see, is that on the DVD?
It's on the DVD.
Okay.
And he has longer hair and he has white hair.
Really? Yeah, I have no recollection of ever watching
really
this.
It's really weird. It's better. Like the tight beard and the short hair, like, he looks better I think it's they made the right choice. They made him.
And a big choice that they make, one of the reasons why we love Sir Hugo Drax from the book is his audaciousness. He's very ostentatious. He's a very aggressive character, the way he speaks, his mannerisms. It's the complete opposite with Michael Lonsdale's interpretation of the character. It's extremely, a very even tonal level, very unemotional.
I don't know if I'm correct, but he feels a little bit autistic. Kind of like,
possibly,
maybe not autistic, but he, like, there's something's not right. Like he's
the part of his brain that says show emotion, like that button.
Yeah,
he switched it off and then he broke
even
the button.
Even when he's upset, the only time where he really feels upset is at the end of the movie when the station's blowing, his hair's messed up, and Bond is tracking him, and then's about he wants a confrontation with him. And he's backing up, and he quickly grabs a gun and tries and shoot Bond.
He does yell at Jaws, you know,
Jaws, you obey me!
The only time he raises his voice. You know, there is an embarrassment of riches as far as choice lines go. I must admit to being a bit partial to an early scene when Bond has arrived at the Drax Corporation. Drax says something, oh, you've arrived at a precious moment, at a time when we can recognize England's one indisputable contribution to Western civilization. Afternoon tea.
Can I press you to a cucumber sandwich?
Yes.
I want to try that.
That is delightful because it speaks to, well, obviously, and this scene is happening in a very ornate, you know, beautifully decorated room, after which two countesses have left the room and he's been playing classical piano. And so there's like this, it's an extraordinarily backhanded compliment. He enjoys his tea. It's also the only one goddamn thing you freaking English people have done in your entire history. You know, but it's
it feels like something the book version of Drax would say if he, once he's exposed as a traitor, well, not a traitor, but as a Nazi, and say, ah, that's your one contribution this afternoon, team. That's why we're going to wipe you out with our Moonraker missile.
Can I ask you a question? I want you to be honest. Have you ever had a cucumber sandwich?
No, I never.
I've never had a cucumber sandwich.
But I'm curious. I want one now.
Is it like toasted? Is it soft bread? Is it?
I would toast it, and I would just cut the cucumber very finely. I'm wondering if I put some mayonnaise in it or something.
Mustard?
Mustard, maybe? I'll Google some recipe and try it. Because it sounds... Mm.
That's the next bonus episode.
Foods.
The dishes of Bond.
It's just going to be us.
Slurping away.
I love the Q gadget. The stupid Q watch.
Okay, when you say you love it...
No. I love it because you have to look at the picture I took and... you have to say it in French, because I wrote it in French.
Q and Peter Parker, même combat. Si. Yeah.
It's a Spider-Man web shooter.
It is, and it works with the wrist. It's all in the wrist.
Oh, another one. I love that he...
Yes.
It's like Batman. He puts his insignia on everything. Drax, why did he put the Moonraker sign on top of his buildings? Nobody's going to ever see that unless they're flying over in a helicopter and they need to know. Oh, that's the Moonraker because it says Moonraker. See? It says Moonraker.
It's funny. And this is maybe where Drax is a little bit hard to grasp. I mean, I love the movie Drax. I'm going to make that very clear. But, you know, if I was to play devil's advocate, maybe this is where he's a little bit harder to grasp, because it really is only at the very end in the Moonraker station where he gives that bizarre speech about law and order in the heavens. He hasn't really said anything like that throughout the whole movie. And you make this point about the Moonraker local being everywhere. This guy doesn't look like or sound like a guy that behaves like that. It's only at the very end that, oh no, he most definitely thinks along those lines. He is a god.
I think throughout the movie he's trying to contain himself.
Probably,
yeah. And near the end he's like, ah, he lets it go.
It's funny. I'm going to be completely honest with you. I like the point about the Moonraker logo, but I thought you were going to you were showing me the scene with the dogs because of how well they're trained.
My brother used to be able to. Well, he's still able. It's amazing. Like he puts. He used to be. His newer dog, I don't know if he's able to do it, but his older dog, he would put a piece of meat in front of the dog. And said no. And
but
the
Drax,
dog
would, Drax doesn't say no. Drax doesn't say no.
Still.
Drax looks at him, and then minutes later, while there's a bunch of saliva on the carpet.
But you see, when they shot that scene, the dogs are clearly looking at the trainer, and they're waiting for the okay sign. They probably cut the audio, but they're still well-trained dogs, see.
That's a great scene, but you know it's a bit of a jokey moment, but it goes to show you know Drax's authority and his capacity of controlling others, be they man or beast.
Can I do an underline,
buddy? It's Hugo Drax. Do any lines you want.
See that some arm come to him.
I do like that one. There's so many good ones. The tedious unloved tediousness of an unloved season is a good one. Afternoon tea, harm.
The only problem with that scene, that line, it is said to my least favorite character in the entire, one of the least favorite character.
Strange character too. Like, what is this guy doing in this
that
movie?
Is
where does he come from?
Prototype. It's meant to be Krebs. Like that's the
that's what you were talking about.
Yeah, we didn't
episode.
Get Krebs, we got Chang, and Chang is such a lame.
They have nothing to do with one another, Krebs and
well, they're the secret henchmen, the same position.
Yeah, I see your point.
Like it's a poor man's replacement, but it is
extremely poor man's replacement. Oh. He's not very charismatic. There's nothing to him. He's not a good fighter. Like
he
Kendo
runs away.
Scene.
He runs away.
Yeah, he runs away. Bond is on the ground. He runs away.
On the entire time they had their fight, I'm like, you know, this would be a perfect moment for Bond to just shoot him.
Or toss that poison in his face.
Because this guy has nothing that you can learn. Doesn't seem to speak English or speak at all.
Well, he speaks English. He tells Lois Childs after the... my goodness, what did they call that thing? The G, what do they call that thing?
Wait, the centrifuge.
Centrifuge. At the end of the centrifuge system, Cha comes in and goes like, Mr. Drax wants you to call him or something. It's like the only line he has in the whole movie.
I had to look that up because he goes to 12 Gs.
Mm-hmm.
You can survive 12 Gs, but most people at 5, they pass out.
At 5, they pass out? Yeah. Wow. So, I've never done anything like that. So
an astronaut, usually they can withstand 7. The plane they used to shoot Apollo 13, it's like 0.1 G. It's not that fast. But it was fascinating to look. I'm like, oh, okay, you can do this. You can survive a lot. It doesn't mean that you're going to be conscious.
Right. You're not dead. Congratulations. Yeah. You're still in a pretty pitiful state.
At 12, most people are on the verge of passing out. So it's actually more or less, from what Wikipedia have been doing, it's more or less actually correct.
I'll give a lot of credit to that. There's a lot of dumb things in this movie, and I'm sure we'll get to them. The centrifuge system scene, is not one of those dumb things.
Actually,
that is a good scene.
Yeah.
And it's one of the rare moments in this film and throughout Roger's tenor. Not the only one, but one of the rare moments throughout Roger's tenor where... Yeah, he's still alive. He's gotten out of this one, but he looks like he's in bad shape.
He's
like,
shaken and stirred.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well played. And I like that. I like it when Bond in the movies looks rattled. Yeah, you got a picture right there. Truly shaken and stirred this time. It's great. I love it. I love that scene. And I've seen this movie, even though it's certainly not among my favorites. It's still a Bond film, so I've watched it a bunch of times. Last night was the umpteenth time. I swear to God, every time I watch the centrifuge scene, I get a little bit tense. I was a little bit tense on my couch last night. I know what's going to happen, and I was a little bit tense.
It's well edited. It's well shot. That director has I don't know if you picked that up. That director, Lewis Gilbert, he made The Spy Who Loved Me and The Moonraker back to back, and he has a weakness as a director. And I was when I was watching, I'm like, oh.
You can only tell one story?
No, not even that. It's not that. It's something that's more technical. There's important plot points. He either doesn't shoot very well or doesn't show and has to have audio of people describing what's going on. When I was a kid, I never got that Jaws actually survives. It's set on the offline. You don't see him. It's just, oh, we found him. Jaws and the little girl are alive.
Only 6 billion miles to Earth. They'll make it. Don't worry.
It's barely noticeable. If you miss it, you think he's dead. Like, there's information that should be shown, and it's missing. It's not a major thing. I was shocked. Lewis Gilbert is almost 100 years old. He's still alive.
Who is he now?
I thought it was...
Bless his heart.
Bless his heart, but I'm surprised that he's still alive.
He certainly looks old in some of those interviews on the DVD. And those interviews were, you know, a few years after the film.
And
it looks
behind,
pretty old.
Yeah. I don't know if he does interviews still to this. I don't think so. He's probably... like fully retired and living very comfortably, but no, he's still alive. Good, bless his heart.
I'll tell you what's not shot poorly. What am I even trying to say? I'll tell you what's shot well.
The ladies.
Corinne Dufour.
Oh my God.
What a sweetheart.
Oh, what a sweetheart. She's so beautiful.
Classy lady.
Funny.
Funny. She's got some charm to her. She's not an airhead. There's good a repartee with Bond, you know. Well, I'm not sure about the 18 carat line. That's a little dumb. Not her fault. She's doing what the script's
that's
asking
of her. And she says something about, "Oh, I never learned to read." And it's good. It's good flirting. It's
very flirtatious, and she's adorable.
She's just oh.
She's well when she's wearing that. I mean, how can that be an official? How can that be a uniform at a space station? I will never know. Only in a Bond film. That said, great uniform, and she's a delightful.
Oh,
she's a peach, as I would describe her. You have hot. Oh, she's so hot. And you have, oh, she's cute. And then you have that mixture of the two where it's like, I'm very aroused by you, but I appreciate the fact that you're not just babelicious. There's like a classiness to you. And that's what Corinne Dufour is. She's hot but classy.
She's not trashy.
I would want to respect her. I would want to
present
her
to your mother.
I would be 24/7 constantly aroused by her, but I would want to treat her like a lady because she earns that need to be treated. Like, she's that kind of a Bond girl. Man, that gets me going. I like her a lot. I like her. I like the classiness of Corinne Dufour.
No, she.
Unfortunately, she meets a very grisly end.
Oh, there's. You know what? We'll go through those two parts. There's two moments, and I need to verify his filmography. But there's two scenes. The scene where obviously Corinne is brutally murdered. But also the scene with what's her name, Manuela. In the alley in Rio, which feel like they're from a horror movie.
Oh, absolutely. Shot very differently. It's completely different styles.
The Corinne that feels like it belongs in a Hammer movie.
Or a giallo or something like that.
Because it's very foggy. The music.
The music.
It's just creepy. I'm like, you know what? I was watching it. I'm like, I'm not showing this to a kid. They're going to be like a very young child would be kind of creeped out by this.
And this is a criticism that several Bond films have needed to take, and maybe it applies a little bit in Moonraker. The tonal shifts sometime. Corinne's death is extremely grisly, extremely horrific, and it happens like 20 seconds after one of the funniest moments in the movie where Drax and Bond they're using pheasants as target practice. You know, it's sort of like the old school, old boys club hunting scene. And Drax presses Bond to give it a shot. You know, there might be a bird that flies by, and then one does. And Bond takes aims, fires. Doesn't kill the bird. Drax, in a very satisfied way.
You missed, Mr. Bond. Did I? As you said. Such good sport.
And like 20 seconds later, Corinne Dufour dies like the most grotesque death in the history of the whole series.
Yeah.
So there's some like bizarre tonal shifts sometimes.
Like, it's a good scene. It's just, whoa. That's the thing. I can't really complain about it because it's well made. It's well shot.
Really well made.
But it's just, ooh, it's a bit gross. Hmm.
And this is in a film in which Jaws falls in love with like a huge boobed blonde midget. Everybody's a midget compared to Richard Keel, but like, why is all this happening in the same? It's one of the reasons I don't hate this movie. In fact, so far I've said a lot more things I've liked than not like. But
there's an insanity to it.
The point I'm making is one of the reasons why it's not at the top. It's like not a top five Bond film. It's just it doesn't seem to always know what it wants to do, how it wants to feel. I find
it's schizophrenic, I guess.
It is a little tonally. It's a schizoid. Bit on the schizophrenic. Yeah, that's how I would put it. I would agree with that. It's just, and it's funny because you got these two on the on the same one of your traditional, your beautiful notes notebooklets, and yeah, you have the two scenes we just described. The photograph at the top we're looking at is when Bond's, oh, such good sport, and the picture at the bottom is the giallo scene or the hammer scene. It's like, why are these two things happening back to back?
I have to mention the gadgets, at least another gadget. The camera and the X-ray case thing that he uses to unlock the safe that's going to give him the next clue to the next plot, which is...
That's how he finds out about the Vinini glass factory.
Yeah, the VT glass factory. Mm. All of these things are now apps. Like in 21st century, that's like that's the super cute camera. When I saw that, maybe even like 15 years ago, I was still, oh, that's kind of cool. It's a spy camera. It's cool. But today you watch it, I don't think people, like a kid would see that today and be like, okay, it's just a camera. I wouldn't think that it's a cool camera.
The child will take their smartphone out of their pocket.
Yeah. And they would be laughed probably because it has 007 on top of it. It's...
Now, what do you think about that? Because this is not the only time in the franchise where things are branded 007. Is this because like only 007 can use them? Or is that because it's like a wink-wink to the audience? This is Bond's gadget. It has 007 on it.
My guess, there's probably a toy of that.
I guess so. There was a day and age way back when there were actual James Bond branded toy merchandise for children. That could have been one of them. Maybe that's why they did it. Sort of a Transformers thing, like, you know.
There's so much product placement in this movie. I think it's the most I've ever seen. And not just like classy brands, like 7-Up. 7-Up's in there. British Airways. Like, stuff that, like, okay, but it's really, it's not an Omega Seamaster. It's not an Aston Martin. It's not the high-end.
Hey, you got to pay those bills somehow. Moonraker was, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but again, those same books I keep quoting, Some Kind of Hero, James Bond Archives. You know, Moonraker was insanely expensive for that time.
Like the price of the first six movie combined?
Come on. Like, that's a lot they've of spent a coconuts. Pretty penny. Sure. It's a lot of vodka martinis, too. But, you know, you got to pay those bills somehow. Yes. Like, it's one of those things.
I have no problem with product placement. It's just that it's...
The brands were weird.
Yeah.
Like that, for Bond. For Bond, the brands were weird, yeah. I agree with that, yeah.
And speaking of, another thing, the thing that I forgot to mention that it's barely mentioned, and after he goes to the glass factory, it's only in this viewing that I understood why the assassins come of the woodworks to try and kill him. Because one of the Drax ladies is working at a glass factory, and she spots him. Probably, she gives him like a look, and you're supposed to infer
she's the tour guide in the museum, and she stops talking when she sees Bond. I noticed that last night, but I didn't put those two things together.
The first time I had to rewind, I'm like, it took me like 20 years to make that connection.
And more to further your point, I had noticed it earlier on a previous viewing, but we're talking like my fifth or sixth viewing of the movie, I only clued in that all the supermodels, whether it's a countess, whether it's a museum tour guide, is all of these supermodels come back. They're the people Drax is setting into space. I like the first like 4 or 5 times I watched this stupid movie, I never figured that out.
This time too, and it's funny because when he goes for the cucumber sandwich, I sees a pair of fine looking ladies, and when he goes hunting, I always
two more.
I thought they were the same ones, but no, they're different.
Well, they all look alike, anyways.
they do. It's silly, but they do. And it follows the most amazing another boat chase.
At this point in this show, I don't know when you're being ironic or not, but I'll let you please take the floor.
He's funny thing is that he's being driven in a gondola.
I stole the joke.
I'm sorry, He goes. He's in the gondola, and assassins start going at him.
In their own bad dola.
Bad dola. But at first, he's being driven by a gondola guy.
Mm-hmm. I know what you're gonna.
But
go on.
I realize only this time that guy is an MI6 agent.
Mm. He's also pointless because Bond has. There's a motor in this gondola. Why is this guy?
And. Yeah, it's a cover, but I mean, your entire job is to pretend to be a gondola pilot. I don't know what the proper
in Venice. Hello,
but it's just like, and he gets killed like a chump. Yeah. And you go on the Bond wiki, and his name is Franco. He has a little biograph.
What does he?
Biography? It's not like
seasoned Franco. MI6 Italian agent knifed to death in a bondo.
Pretty much. But he was in MI6, and I'm like, that's a poor assignment. Fake bondola coordinator.
It was many years ago. I've been to Venice. Maybe not my whole career, but like a summer? Dispatched in Venice, pretending to be like
a trained assassin, and like you're.
Oh,
like,
we don't know if he's a trained assassin.
Well, I'm assuming when you're an MI6 agent, you have some at least some fighting.
Minimal training. Yeah. What do you think of we'll get to the actual bondola, but what do you think of the actual assassination attempt? Because the bad guys come at him with their own boat.
Honestly, at first, I liked it when there's like a boat with a corpse, and the corpse is actually alive, and he starts throwing the knife at him.
The corpse is alive.
Yeah, and he gets knife, but when the running around the chasing and the boats and I was having post 11 lead light traumatic syndrome or whatever. I'm
at
like,
least this one's shorter.
Oh jeez, I was like, not another one.
It's short, though.
It's shorter. Just the moment I told myself, oh, this is getting long, poof, the bondola, like this craft, overcraft, and there's immediately it's ruined again by the double taking pigeon.
Yes. I was wondering if we were going to talk about that. Oh, you even brought it up in your notes.
Yeah.
You know what? One of these days when we get like fat and rich and we have like a great website, we're going to. Like scan these documents and put them on the website. The people need to see. I have the luxury of seeing these note booklets. I want the listeners to see these note booklets one of these days.
I'll make them available in PDF form eventually.
Hope you do. I hope we do because I think they're great. I want to come out. I tip my hat to you, sir, for the effort. But so you've included the double-taking pigeon in your notes, and there's a dog. The dog doesn't do a double take, but the dog sort of like has the hilt out. Like,
there's a guy like drinking wine.
Yes, we saw him. Well, no, not on this podcast, but we saw him in The Spy Who Loved Me. And we'll see him again in Fear Eyes Only. There's another trilogy. Again, it's like, wow, what great craftsmanship. The special effects, well, not the special effects team, but the model making team. No, the engineers.
It's a special effects
team. Special effects engineers team. They made this cool thing. It looks cool. In the context of this scene in Venice, why the F does Bond have this thing? Again, the inconsistencies in this movie.
We're in the era of Bond movies where the, and especially this when they turn into parodies of
pastiche,
themselves.
As Dalton would say, they become pastiche.
They are spoofing themselves and it's a kid's movie. They were really going for kids. I mean,
well, not the dog scene, not the Corinne Dufour scene, not the centrifuge scene, and that. But that's my point. That's this tonal inconsistency.
Yeah, you're right. But they marketed it heavy for kids.
They make Jaws. It goes from a baddie to a goodie, you know. And apparently that was because they wrote in and said we wanted to be a good. So you are right. I'm not discounting your argument. It is a fair point. It also furthers my own point about this movie sometimes doesn't know what it wants to do.
It
doesn't know what it wants to do because it wants to be everything.
But you know, it's a chaotic production. It was made. The turnaround between Live and Let Die, The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker. I mean, Spy came out July 77, and this movie must have been in production, I'm guessing, throughout 78.
78, early 79, something like that. They came out in the summer back then. Yeah. It wasn't like today where, they come out at the end of the year. That's why they're filming in January and February. No, these movies used to come out in like July and June. Like they're filming the previous year already.
Yeah.
And the film is on a massive scale. We haven't even gotten to like the big special effects sequence yet.
You know,
and everything we've done so far has been on a massive scale.
If I had been doing the plot synopsis, I would have went, James Bond decides to land a lady in every continent in a week. Because missions at the beginning of the movie, he's in Africa. I think he's ending the African.
He's on his last leg. I think they mentioned.
Exactly. So that's one. He goes to America where he lands Corinne Dufour. He has sex with Holly Goodhead in Italy. Mm-hmm. And he has Manuela in South America. And he goes to space. And technically, you could say.
SpaceX.
Not only does he have SpaceX, but he goes. Around the world, so that's his mission, to have sex everywhere in the world, and technically out of space, and counts as
moon raper.
It's kind of creepy.
I never would have thought about that. Maybe with hard and long concentration, that would have come to mind. But I see your point. You know, Jaws comes in at some point. He comes back.
Jaws turns into I think you saw my cartoon.
Yeah, you've been flipping the pages, and I noticed the Roadrunner and what's this? Roadrunner and who?
Will E. Coyote.
Will E. Coyote, yeah. It does, frankly, you know, I can sort of see why you've included that in your note booklet. I mean, because that's essentially what's going on.
No,
here.
It is like a Warner Brothers cartoon.
You have the gondola scene in Rio, which is a great idea. I have no problem with the idea, but it turns into a joke at the end. You have your favorite chases of all time, boat chases. You have another one in Brazil in the Amazon.
The thing is that there's so many boat chases in Roger Moore movies. Like, I just realized there's one in the first four.
There's an underwater one in Spy.
Yeah. So. I like the one in Spy.
That's cool. It's pretty cool.
It's different.
But in this one, it's like it feels the boat chase. I like the ending where they're on the waterfall, so Bond takes his hand glider. Yeah, I mean that's a nice touch. I don't have a problem with that. But the chase itself, it feels like they felt for whatever reason, because we've had 16 billion action scenes already, but we needed another one. So let's just have this slow moving boat chase. The bad guys will launch torpedoes. They won't really land close to Bond's boat. Don't worry about it. I do like the moment when. I do like Jaws, despite my criticism of him. I like the moment when Jaws takes the Uzi. He just has this glee in his face, big shiny teeth, and starts shooting the Uzi or whatever it is. I do like that little moment, but it's a pointless boat chase.
It's a pointless boat chase. And, my another pointless scene is the boa. He crashes his wing as his Delta flyer or whatever, and he sees a girl, a woman, and it's like, I'm going to follow because I'm really horny. And there's more.
Either going to lead me to the bad guy because why would she be here? Or I haven't fucked in about 10 minutes, so I'm going to follow her.
He sees another lady, and he's like, and he sees the bridge, which looks like, I'm like, it's the bridge from that director's other Bond movie. The Perna Bridge, so he has a flashback to that from when he was Sean Connery, and he's like, I'm not doing this again. And they still have like a flipping rock that throws him in the water.
What is that doing there?
It's
This is the part, I shouldn't say this is the part of the film, because we've had enough examples of something like this already in Moonraker, but it's another example of things happening in a specific moment just because it's right for that moment, not for the story. Why does that rock flip? What is its purpose? What if Bond hadn't walked on that rock? Oh, but he did, so that's the rock that has like the little button that's going to flip it. Yeah, but why? Because that's the rock Bond walked. Like, that's why it happens? Because that's the rock Bond walks on or stands on? There's no other reason why that happens. There's no other reason why that rock is equipped with that ability. It's just...
so silly.
It's the spoof. You mentioned the term spoof, pastiche, and that's like another example of it. They're just doing... they're doing things... they're not doing it organically. They're doing it because it's a Bond film, and those things kind of happen in Bond movies, so we're going to make it happen again. Another reason why this is not at the top of my list.
Honestly... there's so many deviation this movie takes, and it could have been like each time I got bored, the scene ended 2 minutes later, a couple seconds later. I'm like, oh, a little tightening of the editing, suppressing some scenes that lead to nothing. Like, honestly, the bridge thing, not the bridge thing, but the boa thing. It's just okay, but it's not a deviation. It's just people came to space, get to space earlier. No, but it's pointless.
Yeah, it is pointless. And the joke is not very good. You know, why did you kill my python? Oh, I noticed he developed a crush on me. What? Yeah, not the best you got.
It's a clunkier.
It is a clunker. It is a clunker. But we do eventually.
We missed. We didn't discuss at all the what's it called again? The thing that takes them
gondola?
Not gondola. Funiculaire.
The funicular.
Yeah.
The thing you take to go up mountains by cart.
Yes. We haven't discussed Holly Goodhead.
That's true. We should give her some. You know what? You're right. I apologize.
And you said you love Lois Maxwell.
No, I said I love Lois Childs. Everybody loves Lois Maxwell. No, that's fair enough.
Wrong Lois.
Wrong Lois.
There's also Lois Lane.
Fictional character. I'm fine with Lois Lane. Yes, I do love Lois Childs. I think she's absolutely stunning to look at. I think she's beautiful. And so she's kind of our Gallibrand. Is she as cool as Gallibrand? Maybe not.
She doesn't work. She's proto Christmas Jones.
Ooh, hold on.
I'm gonna be rough with her.
Is this our first disagreement of the since the start of the show?
I'm gonna be rough with her, but I have a point. I feel like, as I previously mentioned, I feel this movie was rushed in production, and some parts were not complete, and I don't think that character is fully developed, because she goes from she has no reasons to be not like working with Bond from the get-go. I don't trust her. It worked for the previous movie, which was The Spy Who Loved Me. The entire movie was predicated on East and West teaming up together. This time they're both on the boat, they're on the same side, so it doesn't, like, Bond would have a reason not to trust her, but her, like, she has no reason. So there's all, she, it feels like something's missing. And at first you think it's because he's a sexist, because at first, oh, you're a woman. But no, he fully accepts her. He was expecting a dude with a name with, with Dr. Goodhead. He was expecting a dude. It's like, oh, it's a woman.
Oh, I suppose you're right, Holly. We would be better off working together. Détente.
Agreed.
Understanding?
Possibly.
Cooperation?
Maybe.
Trust?
Out of the question.
Yeah, I guess my counterpoint, and it might not be much of a counterpoint, but I would say it might have to do with the whole fact that she's from the CIA, who are the best of the best in the business, as everybody knows, so like they're going to try to take credit for as much as possible. My counter argument would be surmised in the scene before they go to bed with one another, where Bond says, you know, understanding, you know, perhaps, you know, trust, out of the question. They are, at the end of the day, he is an MI6 agent.
Yeah, I know.
She is a CIA agent. They speak the same language. They're generally on the same side. They both have their own secrets. And they both have their own missions. They, you know, they eventually come together.
I feel like I'm rough with her, because I said she compared her to Christmas Jones. But the difference between Christmas Jones and Holly Goodhead is the level of the competence of the actresses playing the characters. No disregards to Denise Richards, but she's not the greatest thespian who ever lived. No. But Lois...
She's a good actress. She's a decent actress. I like her a lot. And she gives a good performance, I think.
She's great. She's a great actress compared to Denise Richards, but she's not playing... She's a character that is incomplete. Their relationship doesn't necessarily... Like, to me, it's clunky. It should be... They should have written it in a way that either make it because she's trying to prove herself and Bond is super sexist, make it that, or you make it...
That wouldn't have worked. I mean, no, it wouldn't. We just saw Triple X. But that wouldn't make any sense.
But it starts at the start of the movie. It's clearly implied that he's sexist. So it doesn't work because of the previous movie, but if you take this as the only Bond movie, that could be the learning curve. Like, he becomes less of a sexist dinosaur, or I don't know. He doesn't trust her because he doesn't know whether she works for Drax or she's on the same level.
He doesn't really know what she's doing for a while. Like, he meets her at Drax Industries. He sees her in Venice. She's part of the guests that are going around. At that point, he doesn't fully know what she's doing. It's once he infiltrates her apartment, or not her apartment, but her hotel room, pardon me, and notices that she has standard CIA equipment.
That's midway to the movie, though. There's another.
But that's fine. That's fine to me. That's why they weren't fully partners yet. I don't have a problem with it. I don't think it's because they speak the same language and that usually the British and the Americans are on the same side more often than not.
Or you know what?
They're still different spy agencies.
Or you know what? They shouldn't have had sex in Italy. They shouldn't have slept together. And thus you would still have, like, tension, because the tension is gone. After he has, like, most of the time, the second Bond girl, like, he only has sex at the end, and because there's tension. Like, it's not... But I feel that this movie needed some tension to justify the relationship.
That scene when they meet up again in Rio, you know, he's spying on the airport and then he notices her and she notices him. She's not completely honest. That's a little weird. Like, they just finally learned who each other's working for. And they've had sex, and yet she's still not completely on his side after that. The gondola scene fixes that. Like, they're finally on each other's side after that. But that's like 2 minutes. They go on the gondola, like, right away after that.
After that, they have the...
Not the gondola. I keep calling it a gondola, but whatever that it is. Yeah.
I
don't know what it's called either.
The
funicular. But that's like 20 seconds of the movie, you know.
Yeah, but it's late in the movie, and when they become fully allies, it's like...
Yeah, but it's also just the first time they see each other after they've made love. Agree to disagree on this one.
But
I'm not saying I don't understand your point. I didn't interpret that way, and I don't think your opinion will, like, color my viewing of the movie.
Like I said, the actress playing the character is stronger than the material that she was given. That's my point. She needed a little bit more of a polish, and it would have worked.
Shall we shoot off to space?
Yeah, let's go to space.
Been talking for an hour, so...
Yeah, oh no, I just wrote here what the boy is saying, because there's, like, pretty ladies everywhere, and he's like, I wrote, this is Austin Powers, and it is, like, the sex bot scenes in Austin Powers.
Kind of, actually.
So let's go to space.
Let's go, baby.
Do you want to start with, I'll let you start. Do you want to go first, or should I go first?
Well, I will say that, okay, so the whole radar jamming thing is a little bizarre. I'm not convinced that a radar jamming system will mean that no space stations on Earth can detect that there's this massive station in space, but that's neither here nor there. The fact of the matter is the station looks awesome.
The entire production design is gorgeous.
Again, I'm going to stupidly quote the James Bond archives, and I say stupidly because I can't remember the details at this point, but the Moonraker chapter elaborates the painstaking detail and effort that went into... I mean, this is... I don't know what the process is called, but it was kind of like... It was as slow and painful as stop motion animation, where you can only do a second.
Oh, you mean
the
model effects?
Yeah, and how they inserted optically into the picture.
There's a couple. There's not that many movies that use that process.
Apparently, it was like a freaking ancient process too.
It's ridiculous, but it creates a pristine image.
Oh, it's beautiful.
But you know which the last movie before that used the same technique, 2001.
Which was like a decade ago,
years ago? They didn't do that. I think they did that because the SARS people refused to work on the movie, or they gave them they quoted them an enormous amount of money, and the young people said, screw this, we're doing this on our own. This was complicated and risky, but cheap. You don't do effects like this complex like this. This is insane.
It was like they had the image of space with a space station, then they had to like insert the ship for a second, then they had to do that again because it was advancing in space, and they had to do this
because they I'm gonna start speaking in French, but it is insane because they have to film just one element, go back, film another element on the same print, go back, it's composited in the camera, it's insane. You mess up once, you have to start all over again. It is completely,
and I think they did mess it up once or twice, as I recall reading. I mean, maybe I'm misremembering.
They probably did. It's quite possible. I don't know. I've only scanned the archive and looked at the pretty pictures. I have not read
very pretty pictures. But look, I was streaming this. I have the collection on iTunes. I don't even watch these movies on disc anymore. Man, that space sequence looks amazing. For visual eye candy.
No,
wow.
It's there's no green line, there's no matte line, because like even Star Wars had matte lines. This doesn't have matte lines because it's composited in camera. It's insane.
I know. It's great.
So risky.
Extremely risky. And can you imagine what it must have been like to do that when the laser fight starts?
Ugh.
And this thing comes out 2 years after The Spy Who Loved Me. Absolute madness. Absolute madness.
Like, so much money also.
Absolutely. The space station itself in the interior, you know, it's a pretty solid set. Maybe not as cool as like the Amazon interior. I love that set. I'm not as in love with the interior of the space station set, but it looks pretty good.
But it looks like every Drax Industries looks like it's from the same mine. It's really black and white. It looks... You know, it looked like it reminded me of Apple. Like, it's very clean.
Yeah, pristine and monochromatic. Kind of. It lacks personality.
Yeah.
Which is kind of Drax's personality.
Yeah, it's a little bit monotone.
Doesn't talk with any emotion whatsoever.
Unless you don't obey him.
But we do get a fancy lightsaber fight. Laser fight. And I feel like I've been saying this all episode long. I'm of two minds of yet another thing in this movie. It looks so good. It sounds cool. Love it. Love it. In a Bond movie? Yeah. In a Bond movie? Really, are we doing this?
We're in space.
This sequence kind of encapsulates my entire feelings towards Moonraker the film. Yeah. There's so much that's legitimately, in my heart of hearts, pretty cool. This is so stupid at the same time.
Well, it is James Bond meets Star Wars. And they had two choices after this movie. Either we keep going this way and James Bond's a space spy and he's going to fight aliens. That they could the series could have become Space Adventures James Bond. Imagine we're Bond 2025 and he's been frozen in space and I don't know.
That's the plot for Jason X.
Yeah, they could have went so crazy ways, but no, they said, you know what? We can't do this. We can't go bigger. So we have, like, they did this, the For Your Eyes Only, and it's one of my favorites, but we won't cover this one until...
Yeah, we got a few weeks to go before we get to that. A few months, maybe.
But I've got a few notes on Jaws. Well, not Jaws. It's a thought I had when I was watching the movie. Richard Kiel should have had a kid shows.
Playing Jaws.
Not necessarily as Jaws, but like, I don't know, My Friendly Giant. Because he has... I'm saying, like, you would have named it something else, but he had kid appeal. Like, as a kid, I loved him.
Well, there's that story of him giving the interview. Wait, it's not a story of him giving it. He gives the interview. He says, yeah, these kids were saying, well, why isn't Jaws a good guy rather than a bad guy? Like, I don't know why. For most of The Spy Who Loved Me, he's a pretty scary guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and yet the kids, you know, kids will just see things in a different way. And they saw that character and wanted, he's cool. We're not scared of him. We're kids. I'm not scared of him. I want him to be Bond's friend. Okay.
But sometimes, because in The Spy Who Loved Me, he's always a threat until he drops a stone on his foot. And then he becomes a little bit more silly.
Yeah. I do tend to forget that moment. I don't have a problem with a little bit of humor with Jaws.
No, I don't. But it's why kids gravitate. And he had a good comedic faces. He was he would have worked. He could have had a kid show with Richard Kiel playing. You know, he was actually, you probably don't know that. I'm going to shock you, so hang on tight. He was the Incredible Hulk. The Bill Bixby TV show was not, he was the original Hulk.
Really?
Yeah. And apparently, if you look at the pilot, he shot scenes, but I guess they felt his body type was wrong because he's big, but he's not like super big. So there's some shots in the pilot where it's still.
Really? Because he looks completely different from the guy. I can't remember his name, but.
Lou Ferrigno.
They're not at all alike physically.
No.
Lou Ferrigno is a box. Like, Richard Kiel is, yes, muscle-bound, but a giant. He's tall. He's so... Richard Kiel... I call him Joss. Richard Kiel is so tall, you could almost mistake him for being lanky, because he's so tall.
Let me see if
I can... Can you see some... Are there images of him as a...
Yeah, apparently there are a few images of him... I think it's in the distance.
Because that would be like visual dissonance, like between Richard Kiel and Lou Ferrigno. I mean,
see, I think that's one of them. And it's definitely Richard Kiel.
Oh yeah, you can tell in the jawline. You can tell it's him. You can't tell as much that he's that tall because it's an overhead shot. But
look at his arms and the way that the legs and the foot, it's definitely him.
Interesting. I saw Richard Kiel in a Clint Eastwood Western. He plays a silent bad guy. No, he's not like the main antagonist. He's a heavy. It's not, is it Pale Rider?
I don't know.
Maybe it's Pale Rider. It's not a spaghetti. It's like an early to mid 80s.
Oh, okay, it's a later.
A seasoned Eastwood. You got Pale Rider, you got, damn it, I don't remember what it is, but yeah, if you look at Eastwood's Westerns filmography from the 80s, Richard Kiel is in there for about 15 minutes as a heavy, yeah.
Hmm.
Doesn't say a word.
Also, he's in the Adam Sandler golf movie.
Oh yeah, I don't remember that.
Yeah, he's for there for like a second near the end, I think.
Does he talk?
Yeah, he talks.
Oh, that's
He has
nice.
A mustache. He's later period there, Richard Kiel.
I'd have to rewatch that. No, I'm not going to rewatch that. I'll rewatch the scene with Richard Kiel.
I don't remember. It's not Billy Elliot. It's one of those, like, period.
Happy Gilmore.
Yeah, that's the one.
I think we're pretty much
done.
We've been running for interestingly enough, not quite as long as the book, but we're getting there.
Wrap this up.
Yeah, we should wrap this up.
Oh, wait. Do I have notes on what was happening in 1979? Oh. Funny enough, I took this picture. I'm showing him, Edgar, a picture of a dress that was worn by one of the Drex ladies.
Lady spacesuit.
Yeah, that's from that was actually taken at the, I don't know if it's still around, the Planet Hollywood in Niagara Falls, which is a horrible place. I don't recommend that you eat there.
Does it still exist?
I went there 2 summers ago and still existed, and it was just, it hadn't changed in almost 20 years. Hmm. There were still, you can still
well,
buy.
If the best they can come up with is like the skirt space suit from Moonraker, I appreciate the fact that it's a bit of Bond history, but like, you know what? That's what you guys come up
you
with?
You could probably break the glass and steal it, because it's
no one will notice.
It's at the bottom of the stairs. It stinks like garbage when you get there. Oh, it's a really disgusting place.
Oh, you know what? Just before we wrap up, I don't want to go on a super long tangent because we've been going on for a while, but you know what I thought about for the first time in all my viewings of this film last night when I rewatched it? So we see the supermodels arrive at the station. Like, who are these people? Are they on drugs? Who are these people? Yeah, okay. So you want us to repopulate the Earth after you've killed 6 billion people? I get to do it with a super hot blonde? Okay, sure, sign. Like, who are these people? I don't care that they blow up with the station. In fairness, you don't really see them again, but for all intents and purposes, they blew up with the station.
They're dead.
Who are these people?
I don't know. They're space Nazis? Because they're Aryan looking.
There's your Nazi. Although there's like a couple Asians and black people in there. But though psychologically, they're your Nazis. Okay, yeah, we'll kill everybody so we can repopulate there. I guess that's the Nazi angle in the film.
Oh yeah, we're gonna have you can all reproduce, and they probably neutered all the males and the people that didn't want. And so
there is the allusion to the fact that the first effects of the poisonous plants was sterility. Mm. So you know, maybe there's a little bit something.
My guess is Hugo Drax is actually sterile himself.
That's
why he did all he did, because he's sterile.
Like, oh, maybe
he's overcompensating. So I can't have children. So I'll remake the world. Blah blah blah.
Drax is a more charismatic Vargas. He does not make love. What do you do, Vargas? But like, Drax actually tries to. He accomplishes crazy Nazi things, but he tries to accomplish things. He's a thinker, Drax.
So I'm just gonna go quickly in what was going on in 1979. The Dukes of Hazzard premiered in January? That's a like mid-season premiere for the Dukes
maybe,
of Hazzard. That's
maybe,
weird.
I don't know. I know what that is, but I okay.
Rosamund Pike, Miss Frost from Die Another Day, born in 79, January 79, 27.
Good God.
Sid Vicious from the Sex Pistols died February 2nd. Oh, this is more important for what we're dealing with. The Voyager 1 space probe reveals pictures of Jupiter's ring, and the first fully functional space shuttle orbiter, Columbia, is delivered to the Kennedy Space Center. It's supposed to be prepared for this first launch. Blah, blah, blah. No, not.
Boring, boring, boring.
Well, some stuff. I'm like, I wrote down something about Mobile Site Gundam, but it's.
Mobile Site Condom? What?
No, Gundam.
Okay. Goddamn.
Gundam. Don't make fun of my pronunciation. Oh my God, Thatcher was elected. That's a biggie.
Yeah, no kidding. Thatcher will make an appearance in a later film.
Yeah. Oh, the McDonald's introduced the Happy Meal in June of 79. The Muppet movie was released.
That's a nice little movie.
Oh, Skylab begins its return to Earth after being launched 6 years earlier. Oh, Michael Jackson releases Off the Wall. It sells 7 million copies.
Wow, 79.
Mm-hmm. Pioneer 11 becomes the first spacecraft to visit Saturn. Jacques Mesrine was shot in November of 79. The Iranian hostage crisis took place in November. Oh, and there was a fake nuclear alarm in the November 79, they thought the Russians were attacking us, and it's only somebody that went clunk, clunk on the computer that stopped us from like being, oh, in my case, not born, and you not even conceiving. Oh, premiere of Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Yeah, that's true. That is 79.
79.
It is 79. Good movie. Not a great movie, but I like Star Trek The Motion Picture.
And it's the motionless picture. Sure.
Yeah, I've heard that before. I still think it's pretty enough.
It's better than Star Trek V. I'll give it that.
You know that one? No, I'll watch. No, no. The motion picture is not a guilty pleasure for me. I actually like it. I don't love it, but it's, I like it.
It has a beautiful score.
Very beautiful score, and it has some ideas. Yeah. It feels like a 2-hour version of an episode.
Yeah.
Like not unlike some of the other movies.
Some of the ones are just crazy. So, final thoughts.
Look, it's fine. It's okay. As I've been saying throughout this entire episode, I'm of two minds about a lot of things in this movie. So it's sort of straight down the middle for me. I kind of enjoy it when I watch it. There are moments and aspects to it that I really appreciate and like a lot. And there are other things where I am sort of shaking my head a little bit. So I'm sort of caught in the middle. I'm stuck in the middle.
I'm going to say something controversial.
What's your favorite Bond?
No, not that controversial. I like it better than Live and Let Die. I had more fun.
Is that controversial? Our previous film episode was Live and Let Die, and I was extremely high on it, but I'm not oblivious to the fact that there aren't that many people who are as high as I am on it. A lot of people like it. Some people don't like it at all. I'm like really freaking high on Live and Let Die, so you know, you shouldn't. It's controversial in relation to what I've said. But.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people would put the Moonraker at the bottom of all the Bond movies.
That's unfair. Even myself, who does not love Moonraker, I've said a fair number of nice things about this movie. I can't agree with putting it at the bottom of the list.
No, I put it in the middle, but I put it above Live and Let Die.
That's just crazy.
There's another movie I'd put lower than that in the more canon.
Okay, so at least you're telling me Live and Let Die is not at the bottom of the list.
No, it's not.
Okay,
it's not.
Thank God. Well, there you have it. There you have it. Matthew, can you... I can't remember. Where can we be found on the internet?
I think there's a website that we bought, the James Bond Complex.com?
.com?
Yeah.
Maybe there's a triple W ahead of it.
I don't need
that
these days. It just goes... Boom.
That's true. It'll redirect you. We are on Twitter, which is the account I manage a little bit more, which is at the Bond Complex. At thebondcomplex.com.
It's at the Bond Complex?
At the Bond Complex. I think the James Bond Complex was like too long, so I had to make it the Bond Complex.
Sorry.
If you start searching the Bond Complex, like I've tried it myself,
or
you'll find us.
On the Facebook or everything's going to be intertwined.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but you manage something that I've not even touched yet.
Instagram. We have an Instagram where I try and post pictures related to James Bond. Sometimes it's really tangential. Sometimes I two little doodles on my phone and I post.
Is there? I have to admit, I have not even visited. That is your baby, and it's completely your baby. I will let it continue being your baby. Is there a picture on there of you wearing glasses reading a Bond book?
No.
What? How are you? Maybe I should take over the Instagram account.
There's pictures of our books. The book collection. There's pictures from the interior of the books, and there's some of my little doodles or things.
Awesome. I'm on Twitter as well, at @00pop. So the word @00pop.
I'm at Matt O'Klein on Twitter, and I don't tweet that as much as you do.
I'm pretty. I'm a hell of a lot more active on Twitter than on Facebook.
Actually, I'll officially launch the Facebook and. I'll probably be more in control of that, I think.
And that's why I'm kind of worried that I'm the one that's managing the Twitter account, because I'm already somewhat active on my personal account. Now I got to do the... I'm having fun with the Bond Complex.
Yeah, no.
I am enjoying it. But it's like, oh, shit. No, it's two accounts on Twitter. But it's still fun. So I guess, like James Bond, who always returns...
We will return with a special episode that I've kind of thrown at you last time we were recording. I called it the Bond expansion. Let me briefly explain the idea, which I proposed to you. There's rumors that Barbara and Michael from Eon Production are planning or trying to, and it's always been a rumor from even in the 90s that they were trying to make a spinoff of James Bond with Waylon. That's one time Jinx. And we're going to try and pitch ideas. I'm going to pitch you an idea. I think you have a few.
I have a couple ideas, yeah.
how you can expand James Bond, the IP, in this 21st century of multimedia, multi-platform, Marvel Universe, Star Wars, DC Universe, Fast and Furious franchises that expand to encompass all types of media. So that's going to be the Bond expansion. And depending on how successful our ideas and how much fun we have discussing, I think that's something we could actually bring back every once in a while. Like,
I'm sure the idea you will present is not the only one percolating in your mind. And the two, one of which is a little half-assed, but the two that I'll be talking about are not the only two. I came up with about five or six, and yeah, I had to like let some of them go because it's like I got to concentrate on
another great idea. I'm keeping it in a box, and I'll throw it an idea another time, but I have one that I really worked hard. So we're going to... The James Bond complex will return in the Bond expansion, Volume 1.
Volume 1. Merci beaucoup. À la prochaine.
Au revoir. Bonsoir.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.